This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Michael Pavlich.
Well, the editor, writer and journalist Les Carlyon died a couple of weeks ago at the age of 76. He's the former editor of The Age and editor-in-chief of the Melbourne Herald. He was also a racing journalist, a political commentator, a historian and a journalism teacher, and he's a mentor and confidant to many. We thought, though, this morning we'd look back at the life of Les Carlyon. Andrew Rule is a long-time journalist and a colleague and a close friend of Les Carlyon. He's joined us on the program this morning. Andrew, very good morning to you.
Pleased to be with you in order to pay a little bit of homage to Les.
Indeed. Look, we've got to put it in context here. Exactly why was Les Carlyon such an important writer to Australia?
I think he managed to yoke a soaring intellect and a great native intelligence to a homespun set of principles. I know this might seem a long bow, but something about him reminded me of Lincoln. He was a little bit like the kid from the log cabin who, you know, got to the White House. He came from a fairly humble background. He could easily have, been obscure all his life and ended up in a bad place, probably. But something that he was born with took him somewhere else entirely, and that he managed to communicate that to everyone he met.
Do you think it was his two major works on war, Gallipoli and The Great War, that is perhaps his most important contribution, because they were no-holds-barred, homegrown look at those two wars, and he didn't hold back at all in them and presented a pretty uniquely Australian picture. But not only that, because they were such influential books, that they actually changed our character a little bit, made us a little bit prouder to be Australians.
Yeah, look, you're dead right in picking those books. Les, at the age of, as a young grandfather, the age in his 50s, he, at an age when, to be frank, you know, a man who'd chain smoked all his life might have started to dissolve at the edges and get sick and not do a lot else, and except, you know, play with his grandkids. At that age, Les took up his pen and his keyboard and he wrote the book Gallipoli. Now, he did that because he was dispatched by the Sunday Age as a special to go to Gallipoli to write an anniversary piece in 1998. And what he saw there, and the several thousand words he wrote about it, inspired him and publishers to take the big step further of writing the big book. And it was, at last, somebody of Les's ability had found his line and length. He'd found a subject worthy of his ability.
And an incredible researcher as well. I mean, they're fairly detailed topics that he's taking on there. And you know, he came from a sort of racing writer's background, in a sense.
Yeah, although to call him a racing writer is like calling World War II an international incident.
I was told off the other day by the racing journalist Rod Nicholson. I don't know if you know Rod at all.
I do.
I called him a racing writer. He did the same thing, reprimanded me heavily. So.
Yeah, look.
It was part of his. It was part of his act.
Les is Bradman, and it was. Of course it was. He was, and he was well known for it. But it's wrong to assume that that's all he was capable of or knew about. And it was a passion he had, but it was a passion that sat alongside a vast reservoir of knowledge about many things. He was a prodigious reader all his life, and as well as a fast and fluent writer and researcher. And there was an astonishing amount of knowledge in his head that he was able to assimilate into beautiful words.
I've got a lovely text here from Pat in Brisbane, which I'll read to you. It says, Les Carlyon, the most humble genius, intellect and writer, but to me he was also the best reporter ever because he had the powers of detailed observation beyond belief, and his great commitment to journalism was to report not self-indulgently, writing lecture opinion pieces, His philosophy was to write as well as you can to attract the reader, but to give them the facts, the reader could then make up their own mind. He did write some clearly identified opinion pieces, but he was most committed to fairly informing the reader. An opinion you might like, in this is in quotation.
That's from Pat, and that may well be one Patrick Boyce, who's a great friend and admirer of Les's. I suspect it might be, and if not, it's another Pat. But
I think it is Pat. I'm not sure of Pat's second name. That's Pat in Brisbane.
Pat in Brisbane, that's right.
Yeah, no, he's rung up and he's talked about how close he and fond he was of Les and his work. And he's given us a little quote here. It says, "Lord Kitchener failed to live up to the promise he had never shown."
Yeah.
That's a Les Carlyon quote.
Oh, no, he was the best at those things. He could, the punch only travelled 2 inches. With Les, he never, he was very sparing with criticism in all things. I never, you never heard him single out someone for abuse or very strong language or anything like that, or very rarely, and certainly not in any sort of public forum. And in print, he was even more careful, and so that when he did criticise something even slightly, you noticed it. It was like it was like seeing the tarantula on the angel cake. That's Raymond Chandler once said.
We should talk about. You said he's an avid reader.
Oh,
who were the writers that influenced him?
Many and various, and I wouldn't even know them all, but I suspect his favourites were the great American journalists, and that would include Red Smith, the great sports columnist, H.L. Mencken, the great sort of satirist and, cynical, wise guy writer of the of 100 years ago. I think when Truman Capote died, which is now back in the 80s, I was a great admirer of Truman Capote, as many, many of us were, of course. He wrote In Cold Blood and other things. And by far the best obituary I read about him was Les Carlyon in Melbourne, who wrote as good a piece as anyone in New York or London. So he had a broad range of tastes and influences, but the Americans, Mark Twain and many another, they influenced him a lot. And yet once he lent me a book by Somerset Maugham called The Summing Up, a little book, sort of memoir pieces, and he said, "You'll find some very good pieces in here that are good examples of how to approach things." He had a great eye for quality wherever he found it. And, as a teenager living up in the country, when other kids might have been, down at the tip shooting rats, Les was reading Tolstoy.
Yes, so he had diverse tastes or wide-ranging tastes, if you like.
He did, and he remembered what he'd read, and he could point out, 50 years later, that Tolstoy had described a thoroughbred mare's ears as looking like, a bat's wing, the veins on the thin skin and so on. So he had a remarkable memory for all the millions of words that he'd read. And, of course, that is a great assistance to someone who's a writer.
Sure. Look, he obviously loved horse racing and horses. Were there other sports that he sort of indulged himself in or enjoyed watching?
Although I didn't share his taste in it, but he was a bit of an aficionado of the Richmond Football Club, but particularly Test cricket.
Okay.
He's great. His comparison for Bart Cummings, he more or less invented Bart Cummings. Bart Cummings invented himself, but Les captured it on paper back in the 70s.
Well, he wrote a book, didn't he, we heard before.
He did later, much later. But he'd written pieces about Bart starting about the time he trained Leilani in the early 70s. So we're talking about the years that I left school, and I'm a grandfather now, so it's a long time ago. And Les compared Bart, 25 years ago, with Bradman. He said he was that sort of superior to his contemporaries. So he did. He also was. He knew enough about boxing, as many people in that generation did. Boxing was a sport that inspired great writing, and for that reason, Lees took an interest in it because he was interested in the writing, and he'd seen, you know, what it produced on the page, more than the actual sport. But I remember once he covered a major fight in Melbourne for the Sunday Age as a sort of a favourite of the sports editor, and of course wrote it better than all the others.
Yeah, look, you know, we were very lucky to have, in many ways, to have such a fine writer writing sport, I suppose, for the yeah. newspapers. And, you know, it was only out of love that he mostly did it.
Largely. He managed to combine an interest in mainly racing, which he would write for years, and I'm talking late last century, really. The last 20 years were devoted to his war histories, largely. But he would combine writing about racehorses as opposed to racing. He never wrote about betting or the politics of it. He wrote about the animal and the people. He wrote about business at a high level. He was on first-name terms with the movers and shakers in business in an era when they were well-known, interesting and famous. You know, Robert Holmes, of course. Alan Bond, all those sort of characters that peopled the Australian business landscape in that era. Yeah. He knew them. They'd take his calls. He wrote interesting and insightful columns about them for, you know, national business magazines. He was personally quite friendly with Kerry Packer, for whom he wrote at the Bulletin, and shared a taste in cigarettes, of course. They did share that vice, which does bond people. I don't think he shared Mr. Packer's other vices, but tobacco certainly. He was a great friend of the other Kerry Stokes.
Okay.
And in fact, it was Les Carline who suggested to Kerry Stokes that if he needed to talk to someone to, you know, produce a biography, that he should talk to me. Les had other fish to fry, you know, he had his military books to do, and he kindly informed Kerry Stokes that I would be able to pull off the trick of talking to him for a couple of years and then writing a book about it, which I did.
Right, now you're talking about, well, you wrote a book about Kerry or about Les?
No, I wrote a book about Kerry.
Okay. Now, I should ask you, has anybody written the definitive biography of Les Carline?
It won't happen, I don't think, because I did broach the subject with him at the suggestion of another mutual friend some months before his passing, and I knew it wouldn't work, he wouldn't take to it. He said no. He just shut his mouth and said no. He was a very private person. That's a cliche, and people say it a lot about others. It was actually true of him. He'd had a vexed childhood. His father was a World War II veteran who, I suspect, returned from World War II with all the Florida effects of PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. I suspect his father was a heavy drinker, like many thousands of other former diggers, who may well have been violent towards his older children, and Les was the oldest son. And I suspect that Les shielded his younger brothers and sisters from... Mm-hmm. And I haven't really been told this in so many words by him, but other members of the family have alluded to it in passing. So I think he had a lot of a fairly unpleasant childhood in some respects that he was never really willing to uncover.
Still, it'd be nice to think at some time that someone would pay tribute and and write, you know, the biography of Les Carline, because I think
you need
be
the sources, though.
Well, yeah, I know, but look, it may be left to a historian or writer in years to come, but it's certainly such an influential writer, who knows what's going to happen. I just want to ask you one thing before we head to the phone and read you a couple of texts. There's an American sports writer who changed the way a lot of writing was done, a lot of sports writing was approached, by the name of Damon Runyon.
There was.
And he wrote a lot of short stories. Very entertaining writer. Did he influence Les's approach at all?
Yes, he was one of the Americans that Les quite loved. Loved the way he could do things, the way he achieved an effect on the page. And Runyon was, I loved Runyon's writing when I was a child. So did my father. So did a lot of it. It was enormously readable and accessible and inspired, at least two movies and a Broadway play, I think. So yeah. Les was a fan of Runyon. But Runyon, of course, was, an extraordinary talent. He covered world heavyweight title fights. He covered wars. He did everything, as well as writing the books that the Broadway collections of short stories that really sort of made his name in the wider world.
In many ways, Les was just as diverse. Writing on war, writing on politics, writing on business, and writing on horse racing and other sports.
Very few people. There are some somewhere. You get people who are just talented, and when they pick up a keyboard, they can write fluently and well about almost anything that enters their vision. But in our business, there's only a handful of them that are great across the board. Probably in America and England, we see some that have, maybe the late A.A. Gill, P.J. O'Rourke. There's some people can write funny and they can write serious and they can write about politics or crime or sport with equal skill and equal interest is probably what matters.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it just highlights exactly what an important and what skilled writer he was. Look, we're talking to Andrew Rule this morning, who's a long-time journalistic colleague and a close friend of Les Carlyon. Let's head to the phone, shall we, Andrew?
Yes, please. I'm here.
Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Could you tell us about his mother and his grandmother and grandfather? Because you've already told us about his father. I gather from this that he was the eldest son.
Mm-hmm.
And did he play an instrument?
Well, I can't pretend to know everything, but his mother died at a very old age, not many years ago. So I think she was in her 90s.
Yes.
And she was a Glasheen. Her surname was Glasheen, which is, of course, about the most Irish name I can think of.
Right.
It sounds like something you'd make in a bathtub and... sell to the poor. But that family, the Glasheens, were horse people. They were trotting people.
Right.
And that's where his love of horses and, to some extent, racing comes from the Glasheens on his mother's side.
And music.
I think Les liked music, but I don't know that he was personally musical, but his wife, Denise, certainly is.
Ah, yes.
His wife, Denise, who's... we have to mention Denise. Denise probably knew more about World War One than any living Australian because she was basically the powerhouse of research.
Oh, really?
Denise's books. And I think a skilled musician and singer in her own right, her brother Brian Patterson. And their father was the late Jack Patterson, who worked for the Argus newspaper. So they were... he stuck to the pedigree, the newspaper pedigree.
Mm. Hey, thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
We should ask you a little bit about the newspaper days. And, they're pretty high posts he ascended to while he was working for the newspapers, and he did it in a relatively short time. So his skills as a writer were recognised not just by the public but also by his bosses and the newspaper editors in general.
They were. Look, he became... the editor of The Age in trying circumstances at the age of 33 when his great friend Graham Perkin died suddenly of a heart attack. And Perkin was in his 40s at that time, and this was in his early 30s. He had already been finance editor of The Age for some time and had many posts at The Age as a very young man. I think he was writing leaders, he was a writer of editorials at the age of 21 after moving to The Age from the Sun newspaper. So he was he was a prodigious talent at a very young age, and he could do pretty well anything in a newspaper: lay out pages, write headlines, write captions, and then rewrite the copy so it was better than it had been. I don't think anyone was a better all-rounder at those production skills than Les, but also a beautiful writer in their own right.
Did he have trouble walking away from that to focus on the writing?
Yes and no. I think his personal body clock was indelibly wired to newspaper hours, the old-time newspaper hours. So Les was someone who basically stayed up very late at night, sometimes all night. He said to me once, he said, "Andy, you should always, you know, stay up all night and see the sunrise, or get up early and watch the sunrise." He thought that was one of the best things you could do in life, was to see the sun come up every day, which we might do this morning. And
do it regularly, Andrew.
Yes, you do a bit of it. And he had his roster of friends that he would call late at night. He might call me, or say Gary Linnell in Sydney, at before midnight, and talk for him. He won't keep you. And then you'd talk to him for an hour, perhaps more. And then as the night wore on, at this time of day, he would call up people he knew that worked in radio before they went on air to do breakfast shows and morning shows. He'd have a chat, mostly in Melbourne, this is, of course, but Linnell was in Sydney, but there's Ross Stevenson down here on 3RW, and Les's great friend Neil Mitchell. He would talk to him, and he would often mention something he'd seen overnight and sort of philosophise about it and chat about it. And I think he would often point out amusing things or sad things or things that might have mattered to the radio people. He would point them out and have a chat about them. And I can recall going to work one day and thinking, and bearing in mind I work now these days at the Herald Sun with Les's son, Patrick Carline, who's a fine Walkley Award-winning writer in his own right. And I would pick up the paper and then listen to radios and so forth, and I'd think, there's a little bit of Les in Sydney, there's a little bit of Les on the radio here, and there's a little bit of Les in the newspapers here, because, he'd managed to... He was sort of like the bee that went around from flower to flower, you know, pollinating.
Right, planting the seeds in would flower in stories that appeared during the day.
It was effortless for him.
I got a text to you that's from Ella that says, "I've read and enjoyed quite a lot of the writings of Les Carline. He wrote the foreword for Bart Cummings' book, Bart My Life. This is a book that I will always have."
Yep.
He obviously wrote more than just the foreword on Bart Cummings.
He wrote another, there were two books. One was Malcolm Knox, I think she's referring to the Malcolm Knox biography. Yep. And then Les later, because of its great commercial success, Les was prevailed on to assemble many pieces he'd written about Bart, add to them, and produce a book called The Master, which was basically a series of like long essays about Bart, which is a beautiful piece of work.
Was he excited by the great Australian racehorses that have appeared in the last 5 or so years? Winx, yeah, and Black Caviar, they would have tickled him a little bit, wouldn't they?
They did. He loved both of them. They and many others. He was old enough to remember Tullock, as the 50s became the 60s. Tullock was one of the world's greatest horses ever, and Les was around to see him. He saw Vane, both as a racehorse and a stallion later on. He saw Kingston Town and knew his trainer Tommy Smith very well, and Leilani, owned by Andrew Peacock. He always forgave Andrew Peacock many faults because he thought he was, a genuine horse person who loved good horses, which he probably was. He had a mental checklist of the greats. Manicato, the great sprinter that had crook, rough legs and had to be bandaged every time he ran. And in each case, the people around those horses, he always said racing is about horses and people. It's not about betting or the industry.
Yep. Look, someone's just sent me a massive long text here that I'm not going to be able to read in its entirety, but it was an article about Les Carlisle from The Age when he won the Walkley Award in 2004, after a lifetime of journalistic leadership. This comes from Big Bertha. It just goes through Les was born in northern Victoria, blah, 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 and talks a little bit about how he won his Walkley Award for his magazine feature writing in 1971. Also talks a little bit about journalists, and he's saying that Les thinks that journalists' low standing in public esteem is undeserved. But then I'm a bit fond of journalists, he admits. They're my favourite people. I think one of the reasons for it is, as in a lot of games, is that the more flagrant... Okay, that's just... picked a wonderful time to refresh. Is that the more flagrant practitioners are, the ones noticed by the public, the people who are out to shock or make a lot of noise in various places or fight for culture wars on either the left or right. They don't see the Andrew Rule phone. I don't know if that's
he's I think that's been truncated somewhere, but probably he's saying that those who are able, and in a sense he wasn't actually referring to himself because he was far too humble ever to do that. I don't think I ever saw him use the personal pronoun I in all the millions of words he wrote.
No I and no me.
No I, no me. He didn't do that. But he was an advocate of journalists who could go and do any story anytime, anywhere, from the bushfire to the royal wedding, to the race meeting, to the funeral, and that's the sort of journalism he did and advocated for.
So the sort of sensationalist journalism got up his nose a bit. Wasn't a big fan of it.
No, it wasn't. And Les was never. This is not damning with faint praise either. Don't think that. Les wasn't someone who drew blood much, and he didn't set out to draw blood. That doesn't mean that when it was deserved, he didn't throw that punch that only travelled 2 inches that we mentioned earlier. I think if you read his serious war histories, particularly, when he thought that an important historical figure deserved to be put in context or to be perhaps had their image pruned or perhaps a bit of a critique, he would do it. But he did it sparingly and with good grace, but he did it. He didn't make false idols out of people. And he would take people that were idols of others and perhaps inject a bit of realism into the coverage of them.
An example of that is when he was writing on the Great War, he certainly didn't hold back when criticising Keith Murdoch.
Well, that's probably the most salient example. It would have been very easy. For him to sort of skirt Murdoch a bit. It wouldn't have changed the effect of the book or its completeness, really, but he would have known that it did. He would have known that there was a one percenter there that he'd ducked, and he didn't duck.
Yeah, look, and exposing, a very important part of Australian history in World War One was playing out. So, very courageous in doing that, I would think.
It was intellectually courageous, I think. And you have to remember, he was an advocate. He was for a man who advocated for adults to be able to smoke, eat, drink what they liked, and so on and so on. He was sort of a libertarian in those senses, and to gamble and all the other vices. He had very few of those vices himself. He was actually, there was a whiff of the Puritan about him. He wasn't really a gambler. He might have a small bet occasionally, but his love of racing had nothing to do with gambling at all. He was a funny mixture of motivations. He would defend other people's right to all the vices, and yet he, apart from smoking and black coffee, he didn't share any of those vices.
Bill wants to talk to us. He's actually met Les Carlisle. G'day, Bill.
Oh, g'day, Andrew and Kev. Yeah, I know Andrew too. I met Les in the betting ring, and the thing that struck me, I didn't really know him. I just talked to him because I knew Bart really well. But the thing I noticed about him and Bart, they were both very unassuming and both really very observant about things. That's probably Bart's, you know, Joey Agresta said that Bart's track rider. Bart never misses anything. He's a great one to take it in, and I think Les is in his riding. We had a lovely interview with Macca, Pav, the other day. Macca played a beautiful interview with Les.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually referred to the Tsar as a blockhead.
Okay.
Yeah, because that was funny, you know. And I think that's something really lovely about race courses. You know, people are very equal on a race course. And Andrew, what was the funeral like? Because he had a real mixture of people at the funeral.
Oh, yeah, a big range of people. Not as many racing people as I imagined would have been there. There were some trainers and others. But, of course, you know, Paddo turned up, which was, you'd know, the great, as we know, we're just filling in here for the audience, Paddo being John Patterson, long-time clerk of the course at Flemington, led in 46 Melbourne Cup winners, broken in a couple of thousand horses. He was there, and I once said to Paddo, why is it you blokes all rate Les as a writer? He's sort of a fine writer. Why do you care? And he said, because he gets it right.
That's a great compliment, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. He's a really great Australian. They're real wonderful characters, those people, you know. And and just so humble. I think that's the thing, that when you meet them, you meet a lot of great people. They're very humble people when you meet them in life.
That's true.
Yeah, Clark Hansen. I remember Clark Hansen said that to me once, the ABC sports reporter.
Yeah.
He said that he's interviewed everyone, or lots of sports people over the years, and someone said to him, look, do any of them give you much grief? And Clark Hansen said, look, it's usually the ones that are at the top of their game are just delights. It's the ones who are climbing over each other to get there that tend to have a little bit of attitude. I know that.
That's a good point. Yeah. You'd see that in your job sometimes.
Yeah, you do see that sometimes. Look, just another artist I want to ask you about, and it's the great American poet Charles Bukowski.
Yeah.
Who had an affinity with horse racing and going to the track. Did Les enjoy any of his work at all?
Don't know. I'm sure he'd be aware of it. But, I talked to Les on and off for 40 years. I don't know that he mentioned Bukowski.
No.
But I'd be shocked if he hadn't read Bukowski, because he read prodigiously.
Okay.
He read all the time, really. He had a room full of books that was a sort of a shifting tide of books, and they all became cured in tobacco smoke, which was interesting. You know how you put your name in books when you lend them?
Yeah.
Les didn't really have to. He used to write his name, and he'd just write Carlisle in it, but you didn't have to, because they're all sort of a brown colour on the edges of the pages.
He had suffered from pneumonia when he was a kid, and it was something that plagued him a little bit through his life.
It did.
The smoking wouldn't have obviously helped that.
No, it was without doubt an act of lifelong stupidity. And to his great delight, he didn't actually die of lung cancer, which he thought of as some sort of moral victory. But I suspect that smoking is not your friend, and that in the end it helped get him. But to be fair, he got to 76, he got to have 7 grandchildren, and he got to write all those books and all those millions of words. So all in all, he might have cheated the umpire a bit.
And an incredible contribution. I must say that when I read The Great War, it was just an inspiring book that moved me greatly and rekindled my interest in the topic. And it was just a wonderful thing to read. And very sad that Les has left us.
A brilliant assimilation of the facts into a readable whole. Gallipoli, I found.
We've got to go because the news is coming up. You'd understand that.
Hey,
lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Rule there, journalist and author and close friend of Les Carlisle.